Well, welcome to everyone. I'm very happy to welcome here Kaveh Akbar, the winner of this year's Levis Reading Prize. His book was selected from among a stellar group of books, but his was beyond stellar. And I mean, it was so good, I spent part of my vacation time at a beach where I had people bringing me drinks, not drinking, but reading his book. He is the winner of so many prizes, I don't know if I can list them all, and I don't want to spend all our time doing that. I will note that he founded the website Dive Dapper, an interview site that I've gone to many times to read the fascinating interviews with young poets and developing poets and established poets. And you've stepped away from that now.
Yeah, handed over the reins.
Right, but it's still something highly worth visiting, of course. And he is the author of Calling a Wolf a Wolf, and that is the book for which he won the prize. And many of you probably already have been reading that book. And now we will ask him questions about that and life and the universe. Kaveh, one of the more interesting things, well, there are so many interesting things in your book that I really find fascinating, but one of them is your approach to spirituality and matters about, you know, your really interesting talk and a perspective on God. I recall your poem, Prayer, where you talk about not being so interested in God, but the flower that stands behind God.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that and found that interesting and kind of thought, gee, I didn't expect to, but I kind of agree with that. You know? So, I wondered if you'd just talk a little bit about what you're drawing on in that and what you're struggling with or how that's working into your poetry.
First of all, just I want to say thank you all for being here and for allowing me to be among and for selecting this book, which is just madness to see my name listed alongside all the other names in the history of this prize. It's ridiculous. And thank you all for being here. It still is a strangeness to me to see people who aren't blood related to me holding copies of my book. So that's a real trip, and I thank you for it. That's a beautiful question. For me, if you did a Venn diagram of my poetry life and my spiritual life, it wouldn't even be a Venn diagram. It would be just two circles overlapping. So much of the project of recovery for me has been about rehabilitating those relationships that I had neglected or actively been corrosive to in my active addiction. And those relationships are corporeal and social and physical and psychological and also cosmological. And I think that this book aimed to account for all of those rehabilitations. I'll say too, the line that you specifically mentioned, I think is very indebted to a particular vein of apophatic theology. Apophatic theology being theology that is based around talking about what the divine isn't, so as to better define or think about the divine. So when we're thinking about like Simone Weil, it's a famous instance of an apophatic theologian. This can be a craft tool too. For, I imagine most of the people in the room, if not all the people in the room, are creative writers. Imagine in your heads if I said, imagine the bladeless knife with no handle. You see how that disappears the more I describe it? The more the description comes, the further the actual image recedes from view. This is like apophasis as a craft element, but I think that that approach toward understanding the divine is really oftentimes to me the only one that makes sense, since we're surrounded by what we perceive to be absence. So I think that that line and a lot of the book's approach to thinking about it is invested in that strategy.
I'm wondering if that connects to the form of the poems, because there's a lot of white space, and I'm using that white space for that same sort of narration of an emptiness that's very rich and full.
That's such a generous question, I think. When I was writing this book, it was during a time in my life in which I was surrounded by silence. I didn't publish poems until I was 26 or 27. I'm 29 now. So I've been publishing relatively not very long. But that's actually not true. I published when I was like 19 or 20, and then I began to realize that my poems were just sort of bad stand-up or false or wouldn't age well. And so I stopped publishing for 6 or 7 years. I can never remember. But consequentially, it gave my abilities and my approach a bit of time to catch up with my ambitions. Forever may the ambition dwarf the ability. But it did sort of close that gap a little bit. And so consequently, when I started sending things out, sort of in this big, had a billion things to send out, so it seemed like it happened all at once. But this to say, when I was actively writing the poems, it was a time of intense quiet for me. I was living a very sort of monastic life. I was a hopelessly uninteresting person. I just woke up early every day. I drank coffee for 10 hours. I wrote and read. I taught class twice a week, and I just wrote and read. That's all I did for years. And so I think that there is a way in which the poems in the book sought to create some of the noise and some of the conversation that I didn't really have in my life. So there, lots of the poems work through these sort of breathless rushes of language, through this sort of supersaturation of imagery. That said, I think often about silence as an architectural element in poetry. I think often that silence, and I'm not the first or most interesting person to talk about this, but I think often about silence being the true subject of poetry and language just sort of being the negative space around it, even when the language is sort of supersaturated. I mean, you look at the metaphysical poets, you look at Donne or Marvell or Herbert, and they're talking in these loud plosives, these staccato bursts, these exclamation points all over the place. But I think often about how the quietest silence is often the silence that follows an exclamation. If I say, "Oh no!" right? The quiet immediately following that loudness is often the quietest quiet, the quiet following a gunshot. And so when I think about the medial caesuras and their relationship to silence in this book, or when I think about the blank space on the page and its relationship to silence in this book, it's often acting as a foil against the relative loudness of the actual language so that the silence can sort of form a kind of architecture. Other disciplines think about this all the time. In architecture, actual architecture, I keep using architecture as a metaphor, but in actual architecture, the utility of this room that we're all in right now isn't the walls or the floor or the ceiling, it's the empty space in which we've all put our bodies and we're all moving through. Your chair is useful not because of the textile or the plastic or whatever, but because of the empty space where your body is. And so I'm very, very interested in thinking about how poems might work the same way.
We were talking about your book in one of my classes the other day, and
thank you for that.
One of the subjects that came up is, I wanted to ask you about your influences, because, you know, people saw a lot of connections to, one, deep image poets mm-hmm. like Wright and Merwin, mm-hmm. and to the confessional poets, mm-hmm. Berryman, Sexton, Lowell, and though they're all poets who to some degree come out of surrealism, mm-hmm. and also they all have a profoundly sort of sense of spiritual yearning yeah. and quest in their work.
Yeah.
And they're also poets who aren't really fashionable anymore. I just wondered, you know, who you were thinking about when you were reading or when you were writing.
No, that's a fascinating question, and one that I could talk about for years and years and still not answer completely. I mean, everyone that you mentioned is in there for sure. You started with the deep image poets and the sort of stone and bone era, and that is obviously a huge influence for me. I think that with Merwin especially, I came into middle and late Merwin and the unpunctuated line through Ellen Bryant Voigt's Headwaters. Ellen Bryant Voigt, for those of you who aren't familiar, is a transcendent American poet, one of our greatest living poets, and she built this whole career around being this very, very sort of brilliant wielder of syntax. She literally wrote a book called The Art of Syntax, so it's a little easy to put your thumb on. But her whole career, if you read her book Kyrie, which won all the things that a book can win, she just has sort of the way that Carl Phillips you think about as being this sort of master of the sentence. I think of Ellen Bryant Voigt as being the master of syntax, but very traditional syntax, commas, periods, colons, this sort of thing. And then her book Headwaters came out, and there's not a punctuation mark in the whole book. And I remember the first poem I read from it was a poem called Groundhog, which is on the New Yorker website, which you can find if you look. It was one of those, you get a half dozen of them, maybe a lifetime, those moments where a piece of art just completely rewires your brain into thinking about what is possible to do with an aesthetic piece. It was like, oh, well, if I can do this, I can do anything. The poet Chris Forehand talks about syntactical pickaxes. You land upon a certain rhetorical gesture or a certain syntax or a certain form, and that will chip away at whatever partition exists between you and the content that you're trying to access but can't necessarily get to in your current approach. Discovering Ellen Bryant Voigt's Headwaters allowed me to explore the unpunctuated line, which then allowed me access to the kind of play with urgency and momentum and inertia and centripetal force that I think really, really allows most of this book to function the way that it does. And then, like I said, that led me backwards into middle and late Merwin, and that led me all over the place. I could talk about just this forever, but it's all over the place. My Berryman inheritance is profound and something that has deeply vexed me, because Berryman is a very sort of fraught poet, a very sort of problematic poet to look at, but to deny my inheritance from him would be just patently false. I've written this lengthy essay that I'll probably never publish about trying to grapple with Berryman's legacy as someone who is profoundly inflected by it, but also deeply troubled by it. I don't think that any poet has ever gotten so close to the sonic texture of spoken American English as Berryman, but I think that the methods that he used to do it were problematic, and reading him talk about it sort of amplifies its problematicness. That said, my favorite Berryman poem is 11 Addresses to the Lord, which is not a dream song, and which you can enjoy without the cringing that happens when you read those first 77 dream songs.
Your book, Calling a Wolf Wolf, incorporates poems from your earlier chapbook, which mm-hmm. was solely focused on recovery and that kind of thing. And then when you took those poems into the book, you restructured things. And but even so, there is a kind of development that has a little bit of a narrative suggestion, of course, of the book. And one of the early poems in the book is Portrait of the Alcoholic with Home Invader and Housefly, which, among other elements that are fascinating about it, the content of it is fascinating because it involves this attack that is impossible to forget once you read about it. Mm-hmm. And also what's very difficult to forget is the response of the speaker in the poem, who seems like, oh well, a home invasion, mm-hmm. what the hell? I got stabbed. We'll see if I wake up in the morning. I was interested in how that worked on you. Were you conscious of trying to develop a certain kind of developmental sense in the course of the book?
Well, the experiential referent toward which it points had no consciousness at all. There was no self-reflection during that time of my life. That time of my life was a time when I was getting burgled and robbed with shocking regularity, and was also a time defined by my just sort of lurching from crisis to crisis. There was no reflection. There was no because this, then this. It was just, this happened, and we'll see what the next thing is.
Well, later, you write a poem called Wild Pear Tree.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I love that poem for a number of different things, but also because of the relation of the speaker to his cat.
Yeah. Let's talk about cats.
Yeah, I identify with that. Cat lover. And in addition, I also like pears.
and, me too.
In that poem, you really like some pears because you take a bath with them.
Yeah.
Or the speaker of the poem does, anyway. I was interested in how that poem arrives at a real marvelous sweetness that is shared with the animal world. That it reminds me a little bit of what James Dickey tried to do in his poems, where he's always trying to break through that barrier and to live among the animals. We could probably say he might have been animal in a bad sense, too, but anyway, he certainly... That's an achievement of his I really enjoy. In that poem, I really like that aspect of things too, which seemed part of the growing spiritual development.
So that's the first poem in the book after the frontispiece poem. And it really is sort of a poem for my cat, which is a silly thing to say, but it isn't. My cat was my only companion for a long time. And he is, in my current life, the person who has really sort of known all of the me's that I've been. I got him when he was, his name is Filfy, F-I-L-F-Y. And I got him when he was 4 weeks old. His mother had rejected him. He was the runt of his litter. He was flea bitten. And, you know, you could literally, like, if you pinched his fur, you would come up with, like, a pinch of fleas. And he had ringworm and roundworm and a respiratory infection and ear mites. And his eyes were swollen shut. I thought he was blind, but it was just he had so many fleas. And we just sort of nursed each other to health. We were kittens together. There were, I mean, not to get too war story-y, but there were lots of mornings or nights when he would be the one who came and sort of pawed at my face, and I would sort of wake up and realize that I hadn't been breathing. Like, this is like a real thing that happened, and he was the only one in the house. There's also another instance where I left the front door open one night. I mean, it was cold because I couldn't be responsible for anything. And lots of cats, if you leave the front door open, will sort of dart off and never to be seen again. When I woke up the next morning, Filfy was in the doorway, and all these neighborhood cats were on the sort of like front area trying to come in, and Filfy was just there, like guarding the doorway. Like, so we were really in it. I'm getting goosebumps talking about that. We were really in it together. And yeah, I mean, that poem, I think, is for him.
Yeah, I love the humor and the line where you say, it was January in both directions.
Yeah, it was January for months in both directions. Yeah. And all the days in the year lined up with the door, we deflected each saying, no, you will not be needed or whatever. I wasn't interested in anything, you know.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed this collection. This is sort of related to David's question. So in that workshop, we were talking a lot about the surreal images and the deep images. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your process for settling on the images that you settle on, and how we were talking about they kind of resist logical or intellectual interpretation in favor of more guttural or visceral like feelings.
Yeah.
Just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, which is very much indebted to the deep images and to the surrealist and to the, you know, Breton Surrealist Manifesto and, you know, all these things. But it's so hard to talk about this stuff in any sort of credible way, because if any writer is actually being honest about it, they admit that it's very sort of Here Be Dragons-y, at least any writer I've ever met. I think that so much of the satisfaction in image for me comes in getting the tenor in the vehicle as far apart as possible without compromising clarity, which is to say, I want what I'm literally saying to not have any sort of denotative or connotative relationship with what I mean, except for the sort of like amorphous sense that it absolutely coheres, which is a ridiculous thing to say, and there's no actual way to sort of chart that or quantify that or anything. But widening that gulf, again, without compromising clarity, because you can just get into frivolity if you do, is the whole game to me. So that's what I'm really, really interested in. Horace says that a poem should delight and instruct, and Frost later cribs that and says that a poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. But it was really Horace who said that. And this is so central to my understanding of what it is to be a poet. I think that a lot of us sort of gallop towards wisdom, delight be damned. And so much of the fun of it for me, so much of the way the poem works is to get to nail that delight.
I'm interested in your day books that you keep. I was reading an interview where you talked about them and how you stockpile away these things that you love, things you overhear on the sidewalk or in the grocery store, which I do as well. And I was wondering how they just literally make their way into your writing. Do you go back and review your books often, or do you stash it away and then leave it in the book but not really flip through it anymore?
Yeah, I have, I mean, thousands and thousands of pages of just notes and stray things that people have said, both in physical and digital forms, and just things that I've thought and things that I've read, and there's no sort of organization to it. I don't even, like, date anything, so it's just this mess of language. But I guess there are some writers who just stare at a blank page till a poem appears, but I have no idea how one works under such miserable conditions. I need some sort of moat of language around which the pearl of the poem can aggravate. That's a metaphor that tracks, right? Yeah, I need something there. It always begins with language or with a phrase to me, and I have full faith that the language will always lead me to my content, not the other way around.
I interact with a lot of like undergraduates and also high school students.
Mm-hmm.
What advice might you have for beginning younger writers who are just trying to get into it every day, writing, make something?
One of my first degrees was in English education, and I taught high school and middle school. And honestly, I think just having texts be available without the sort of compulsion or without any sort of obligation or without making it seem a responsibility. Growing up, my mom would always go to the library once a week and get 20 books, and they would be just completely different things. An anthology of Mad Magazine and a biography of Hakeem Olajuwon and a book about photosynthesis and, you know, like just completely unrelated things, and just put them in my room. And there was no oversight, there was no anything. We weren't a big TV household, but so that was my fun. Just like learn about Hakeem Olajuwon, or I would learn about race car driving. Just like whatever the books were that were in my room is what I would learn about. And I think that that made reading seem like a site for discovery and a site for satisfying an unquenchable curiosity and not the sort of thing that you do to be able to figure something out. It wasn't a solution to a problem, right? Or a puzzle to be put together or a riddle. You know, it wasn't any of these things. And I think that that sort of relationship to reading and writing is the bedrock upon which all of my other pedagogy is built, is just reminding oneself and one students or one that it is a literal miracle that we can sort of arrange these runes, these ink runes, in such a way as to provoke lacrimation or laughter, right? Evolutionary biologists talk about laughter as this sort of like herd among this signifier, right? It's the reason why when we watch a movie alone, we don't really laugh much, or maybe we chuckle to ourselves a little, but if we watch a movie with people, right, we laugh a lot more. And it's because laughter is this sort of like signifier of amongness, or signifier that you're among your herd or whatever. And it's always struck me as the most endlessly profound thing that if I read a book of Dorothy Parker poems in 2018, and it makes me laugh in the solitude of my own bedroom, that means in my lizard brain, there is something that sees me as being among, in my herd in that moment. There is like an evolutionary response to seeing Dorothy as part of my tribe, even though she's long dead. This is necromancy, this is whatever you want to call it. This is, if you can't touch the magic of that, if you can't experience that as magic in your life, naming something doesn't make it not magic. We can say it's like communion or, you know, a response to literary, whatever, you know, but that is as close to literal magic as I think that I know.
In your poem, Yeki Bud, Yeki Nabud, which, for if you don't know what I'm saying, it translated in many different ways, mm-hmm. which I think is part of the magic of the phrase, but mm-hmm. it's the Farsi equivalent of once upon a time, which yeah. is an equally senseless phrase. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
But actually, that phrase does mean a number of things that are quite interesting. There was someone, there was no one. There, you know,
this once there was and how much there was.
Yes, it's kind of this statement and counterstatement right from the start to put the listener into the right frame of mind to accept a fairy tale or a fanciful tale or a fantasy.
Yeah.
And thank you for teaching me that by having me read your poem. But also, in the poem, what one might expect to find then would be some sort of fantastic thing. And there is that there. But the fantasy is based ultimately, in the end of the poem, on a son's relationship with his mother, mm-hmm. who he dances with in the mm-hmm. bedroom, and the transformations they go through that are kind of magical mm-hmm. while that's happening. I not only wanted to praise the poem, but I also wanted to just offer you a chance to chat about how that had.
First of all, thank you very much. I think that that's a very, very generous assessment, and I'm grateful that you actually looked it up and did the sort of legwork. It's this funny thing where we see a Latin phrase in a poem, we don't hesitate to be like, what does Dolce et decorum est me. But the second we see like a Farsi, right, it's like, well, I guess they just want me to look at it. But yeah, so thank you for that. It's another one of those things that just sort of arrives. You know the feeling of an arrival or a gift by the sense that you don't have any pride in it. Even the least romantic, most skeptical writers among us talk about hours flying by, or, you know, such and such a phrase just came to me. It's hard to speak of what happens when we're writing without mining the language of the supernatural. And I'm not the most skeptical anything. And so I think that it's so hard to speak credibly about this. It's so hard to try to wrap language around what I sort of only loosely understand to have happened. It's not even something I can put in the active tense. But I'm grateful for the gift of it. It felt very, very true to me.
Yeah, the person after whom the prize you've won, his name, Larry Levis, he had an experience like that early on in his life when he was very young. He decided that he was going to either continue in his fascination with writing and with poetry specifically, mm-hmm. or give it up, depending on whether or not he could produce at least one poem that was worth something. And he took a risky move because the person he allowed to help him make this judgment was Philip Levine. You know, that was a risk. And I recall, too, that one day when I was in college, I started working on a poem, and when I looked up, it was nighttime, and I had blown a really good date I had set up, and I realized, oh, well, I'm screwed. Now I guess I'm going to have to be a poet. Clearly, my priorities are not normal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's beautiful. And I mean, I am someone who is wired at a sort of neurological level to seek narcotic high, and having written is the best narcotic high that I have available to me. And so I chase that high with the same fervor and obsessiveness and compulsivity that I chased other highs in my old life. The relationship to the high is absolutely no different than it once was. It's just this one doesn't make the people who love me sad as often.
One of my favorite things in Calling a Wolf a Wolf is the ending with in the portrait of an alcoholic stranded alone on a desert island is the boat I am building will never be done. That resonated really hard with me because I suffer from chronic illness, and to even go to college is very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. I have epilepsy and have seizures quite often, and there's just nothing I can do about it. So my question is, what advice do you have for people going through extreme bouts of depression and struggling?
That's a big question, and I thank you for the spirit of it and the candor of it. And I'm glad that that last line in that poem clicked with you. It is very much deliberate to situate that at the end. The boat I'm building will never be done, because I think that the kinds of recovery that we're talking about, while very different in nature, are both fundamentally horizontal. It's a place that we march towards and never actually arrive at. I will say that the Russian defamiliarist Viktor Shklovsky, who wrote this famous manifesto called Artist Technique, if you've never read it, you should read it. It's freely available online. His big phrase, the big sort of Russian defamiliarist credo, was make the stone stony, which is to say, undo the damage of habituation in your art. Walking to campus today, every person in this room walked past dozens, if not hundreds, of trees. Just in the short walk from the car, I know that we did. But how many of those trees could you describe with any sort of fidelity? Probably none, right? This is what he means. He's saying the tree has become not a tree, but a signifier for trees, for our sort of psychic idea of trees. And the damage of habituation has made it so that we can no longer really perceive trees at all. And so what the artist does is return to the tree its tree-iness in their art, return to the stone its stoniness, return to the table its tableiness, return to political unrest its political unrestiness, to grief its griefiness, so on and so forth. This is the project of the artist, is to undo the damage of habituation. And I think that there is a reason why people with some sort of alterity have often been the great artists of their time, or people who perceive themselves to be on the outside looking in. There's a craft reason for that. It's not just some like something is taken away from you here, make up for it creatively. There's an actual craft reason, and it's, if there is a sort of king sitting in his throne, eating a turkey leg, drinking from a golden goblet, it seems altogether fitting and proper that the king should have his turkey leg and the goblet to the king. But to the person being rained on, looking in, face pressed up to the glass, starving, it seems very, very strange that the king should have that turkey leg and that goblet. There is a kind of perspective afforded to people writing from alterity that grants them easier access to that sort of defamiliarist perspective. And I think that it can be wielded and bridled and harnessed powerfully in your art. Billions of different artists have found billions of different ways to harness and bridle that, but ultimately it is something that I hope you'll be able to figure out a way to harness, and I think you will.
I like your interest in the essential nature of being a poet as being a magician, and it took me a while to discover that, and I think that was maybe the crucial moment of discovery in my development as a person and a writer. And in your poem River of Milk, that's one of the ones that really takes me away and completely immersed me in that idea, because it has an uncle who's a dervish and not a whirling one. Maybe his pupils whirl, but not a whirling dervish from Turkey. The other kind that comes from where you come from, your heritage from Iran. Yeah. In that poem, and this is something that I really like about your work, is that in the midst of some of the most inventive and adventurous writing about what might seem to many readers as kind of foreign cultural aspects of what they're reading about, then it'll swing suddenly back to something that seems more personal and like in it you mention a box of birth records. And because I was adopted, a phrase like that is going to really resonate with me as well. And I know that the struggle to find your way into any culture, I recall you saying in an interview that in a room of Americans, you don't feel American, in a room of Iranians, you don't feel Iranian.
So, very true.
And that's that outsider status that you were just talking
about.
In that poem, it ends with, it's true, I suppose, you grow to love the creatures you create. Some of them come out with pupils whirling, others with teeth. And I understood that to be not only a warning to the reader, but also to the creating self, the creator of that poem.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's beautiful. I think that that's a beautiful read. I think that writing is... I'm not someone who thinks that nothing happens in poems. I don't think that there's ever been an inert poem. Even bad poems, even a poem about a happy snowman, forces someone to become conscious of the way that they're metabolizing language, which I think, especially, I hate the phrase now more than ever, but I think that being cognizant of the way that we're metabolizing language is incredibly politically potent. There's no such thing as a politically inert poem. There's no such thing as a spiritually inert poem. And so I think that we have responsibilities. I think we can write whatever we want. I think you can do whatever you... I write a billion poems that I'll never publish. But I think that in thinking about what we put into the world, we really have to be conscious about the bend of it. What work will this do? Is it being rigorously compassionate? Does it have both delight and instruction? I think that all of these are questions that I'm constantly asking myself and sounding my poems against. I lose no sleep over not publishing this or that. The imagination is a well I can draw from again and again. Experience might dry up. I'm not a particularly interesting person, but imagination will never go away. So long as I actively, consciously build towards a life that keeps me permeable to wonder and bewilderment, the poems will keep coming.
Well, that was an aspect of that poem too that I thought was another aspect of the cautionary tale that it tells, is that this dervish who is a powerful person mm-hmm. who can control a river of milk that mm-hmm. flows under the village, ultimately pays the price for that, mm-hmm. is torn to pieces by the villagers mm-hmm. when they think he's not using his power to save them from a drought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, I think it can happen to creative people who are successful in their creation. Others want to know how they got there. Yeah. They think they're going to find out, like, what pen you use.
That's such an interesting thing, because I think that oftentimes people are looking for the quick answer to get this or that, or to, as if there's some shibboleth or some secret handshake that will immediately grant you access to writing a certain kind of poem. I think it's a very linear thing. I think it's a great sort of terrible blessing that it seems to me to be very linear. You put in X amount of hours reading and writing, and your poems develop and become Y amount more complex and interesting and true. When I was getting my PhD, I used to teach these comp courses, and I got my PhD at Florida State University, and there's a huge, huge Greek, like, fraternities and sororities and stuff. I think it's like 80-something percent of the college or something like that. And so when they would be, like, freely assigned to write essays about the topics that they're choosing, I got, like, a weirdly staggeringly large number of essays about bodybuilding, which clearly I have no relationship to. But it was interesting. I'm always compelled by reading about things that I know nothing about. And one of the sort of things that they would constantly say is, a good body is the one thing you can never buy and you can never take a shortcut to. Like, you just have to put in the hours in the gym. I think that that's so true of writing, too. Like, there's no residency that, like, spending a week with this or that sort of monolith will grant you access to writing. I teach in 3 MFA programs, but there's no MFA program that's going to do that work for you, which is sort of sometimes makes me feel like everything I do is a farce, even though I don't actually believe that. But just have to spend the ass and chair time, and you have to go to the library and pull out 20 books and just post up. The famous example that people like to use of the sort of naturally talented, just imbued with the song of the creator, whatever, poet is Rimbaud, who is this enfant terrible. He's running around Paris just drinking absinthe and writing these transcendent poems. But if you actually look at the shooting Verlaine in the hand just recreationally and then going back and writing a poem, but actually, if you look at the actual, at the time, you had to sign in to the library every time you wanted to go into the library, and his name is in those registries every single day when he was in Paris. I mean, whatever he did at night, he was still in the libraries every single day. And this is what I'm talking about. Like, there's no, even for Rimbaud, even for prodigies, there's no shortcut. This has to just be the substance of your life.
Yeah, I really agree. I always think of, that was really the lesson of that play Amadeus, because Salieri thought that Mozart was getting dictation directly from God, and that was cheating.
Right.
And in fact, and the play and the movie sort of suggest that a little bit, but in fact, if you go examine the manuscripts of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart that Norman Duby calls the great white shark of music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy who could be hung upside down at a piano and play a song upside down and backwards. He could play music that way. You know, that guy revised. He revised. So
I
would tell my students, forget it.
Yeah.
The geniuses revise.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, Beethoven as a child would have people from the court, like, just massaging his hands after he was done playing and feeding him luxuriously so that he wouldn't have to tire himself by feeding. Even he had to spend the requisite ass and chair time practicing scale. There's no, I mean, and granted, this is not to say that there aren't advantages and accelerants in this process, an MFA being one, but there's no secret handshake.
When you were writing in Emily Dickinson's room, what pen did you use?
First of all, I used a Muji 7mm pen, and I was writing in a Muji notebook. I'm not precious about very many things, but Muji pens are They're super cheap. They're like a dollar each, and they're just the most satisfying pen to write with. And I have like a billion. I've said somewhere in some interview or somewhere online, I've said that I use Muji pens. So sometimes now people will just bring Muji pens to me. I had a student who was like, I bought 20 Muji pens to try out because you said you like them and I hate them. So here they are. But that story is actually such a trip because I was asked to read at the Amherst Poetry Festival, Amherst, Massachusetts, where Dickinson is from. And they did the whole thing, and I said, yes, of course, I'll come read in Amherst. And then a few days later, they were like, oh, and by the way, if you want, one of the things that we can do is have you actually spend a morning writing in Emily Dickinson's bedroom. And I was like, in the history of burying the lead, this is up there. If they would have just led with that, you know, I would have ridden a donkey to Amherst. So that was definitely one of the coolest poetry anythings that's ever happened to me.
Thanks so much, Cobb.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.